You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
The depth and reach of this scandal is so profound that I think it's going to be quite some time before we can really understand the full length of it and breadth of it. It is of epic proportions.
We begin with Stephen Weiss. That's an attorney for one of some of the fraud victims in a history-making scandal on Wall Street. Yes, this man had a list of investors. The feds are now checking it twice, but no one would call Bernard Madoff Santa Claus. No, the Wall Street trader legend Bernard Madoff is at the center of a scheme, a scandal, a Ponzi scheme, a so-called pyramid investor scheme that may have people not referring to them as Ponzi schemes anymore, but Madoff schemes from here on out. It could be worth $50 billion. They're still counting the losses at this point. Joining us now is Diana Henriquez, who's a senior financial writer for The New York Times. Diana, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, John.
Well, let's talk first of all. You know, Ponzi schemes are basically the so-called pyramid where you use old money or early money to pay, or you use new money to pay old investors, and the thing grows by sort of its own kind of delusional buzz, and then when it crashes, everybody ends up losing. How does this scheme differ, aside from the scale, from others in the past?
Well, these kinds of scams have been around forever. They used to be called the Peter to Paul schemes, as in robbing Peter to pay Paul. Then, of course, Charles Ponzi came along in the early 20s and gave them their name. Whether Bernie Madoff is going to rechristen them, we don't know. The interesting thing about this particular scandal, John, is that we don't actually yet know exactly how he constructed it. He has himself called it a Ponzi scheme. According to documents filed by the criminal prosecutors, he confessed to his sons on Wednesday night that his asset management business was simply, as he put it, basically a giant Ponzi scheme. And he put the losses at $50 billion. Now, forensic accountants are still trying to confirm both the scale of that and to figure out how he did it. So, at the very least, he's a smart man, and he certainly knows what a Ponzi scheme is.
Exactly.
So if that's what he called it, we're taking him for his word.
Well, at the very least, and you note that he has already confessed, at the very least, just the paperwork itself indicates that he went to enormous lengths to keep something operating there on the, I guess, the 18th or 19th floor of the Lipstick Building over on the Upper East Side.
Yes, he actually had a quite legitimate business on the 18th and 19th floors. He has for years been known and built his reputation as one of the leading market makers, first in NASDAQ stocks in after-hours trading, way back when you could only trade stocks when the stock exchanges were open. Bernie found a way to trade stocks anytime you wanted to, and he operated one of the early after-hours trading operations and then became one of the largest market makers, you know, bidding and asking on stocks as they were offered through the day and through the evening. And that was the core business. That's what we on in the Wall Street journalism business knew him as this key trader for first over-the-counter stocks and then all kinds of stocks.
And with returns that always went up, never down, 1% monthly.
Yeah, not on that business. On that business, he picked a spread from the difference between what he bought and sold at. What no one really knew, John, was that on the 17th floor, he had another business. The people inside the company called it Bernie's Hedge Fund. He called it an asset management business. But it was that business that was taking in assets from customers, apparently first friends and friends of friends and people steered to him by friends, and then increasingly, as you said, large investment funds, hedge funds, European banks, foreign investors now from around the world, who've all funneled their money into Bernie's investment accounts because, as you say, he had these incredibly reliable, stable, not spectacular, but very consistent returns year in and year out.
And Diana, on that 17th floor, I read somewhere that he's claiming he pulled it all off by himself, including this very elaborate paper trail, financial records that it appears now were false.
That's true, Adora. He told prosecutors, and according to an affidavit filed by an FBI agent, He told the agent when he was arrested that, no, there was no innocent explanation for what he did, but he acted alone.
Is it possible?
Well, everyone is raising their eyebrows over it. We don't have an alternative explanation at present, and I don't want to run, drive beyond my headlights here, but just looking at Ponzi schemes in general, small ones can be run for a long time by a very small number of people.
And it's also
big
true
ones
that
can be read for a short time by a very few number of people, but this strains the definition.
Although in the sort of computer era, it's easy to at least deliver the illusion that there's, thousands of accountants and account executives working on your money when it could be just one guy with a laptop, right?
Well, that's a good point, John. And with respect to Madoff, you got to remember, this guy was into electronic trading when everyone else thought it was crazy. I mean, it's true, he's a 70-year-old grandfatherly-looking fellow and actually one of the nicest people I've ever met in my line of work.
Wow.
But he was computer adept long before Wall Street was thinking in terms of computers. So it would not certainly be beyond him to be able to construct a cyberspace entity that looked formidable. But we can't rule that out. But there are still just a lot of practical little chores that need to be done here. And he's not the kind of guy that you usually look for. In banking circles, they tell you always be suspicious of the guy that never takes a vacation. Because if you're embezzling or if you're running some kind of scam, you usually need to be there to keep an eye on it,
right,
and keep everybody else away from it. That wasn't Bernie. He took lovely vacations in France and traveled on his yacht.
And he had a life. He had a real life.
He had a real life. He was involved,
right,
in charities, as you know. He was a beloved figure at a host of country clubs from Long Island to Palm Beach. So that didn't seem to fit that model.
Well, before we go, let's cover three things here. One, what are the names that appear to have ended up on his investor list, and what is the likelihood that some big funds might actually be brought down as a result of this if it bears out to be as valuable, as huge as the $50 billion figure? And finally, I really want to discuss the difference between Bernie's little hedge fund and traditional hedge funds, because there seems to be a little more similarity, if you're asking me, but I may be naive on this. First of all, the names, though.
Well, obviously, a lot of old faith's names have already surfaced. We know that the Wilpon family, who owns the New York Mets, they've confirmed that they had a stake in his funds. We don't know how big, but it's rumored to be substantial. We know that Norman Brayman, who owned the Philadelphia Eagles, another sports team owner, a former owner, had a substantial stake in the Madoff funds. He's confirmed that as well. This morning, we hear that Mort Zuckerman, the real estate magnate and publishing tycoon here in town.
And talking head. Famous talking head.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of big names, and even more worrisome, a lot of big charitable organizations. He served as treasurer of Yeshiva University. There are a number of big and small charities who literally had their whole endowment entrusted to him.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's quite
pretty devastating.
There will be people. There are people who were, pretty wealthy people Wednesday morning, and on Thursday morning were broke.
Wow.
I mean, it's the kind of thing that echoes of the 1929 crash that you read about in history.
That's insane. Well, obviously more details to come out, and, rather than characterizing it as insane, let's talk some economics here before we go.
Yes.
Hedge funds are typically leveraged like 30 to 1 in some cases, before the financial meltdown, even more than that. I mean, it seems to me that the whole idea of a hedge fund is to pay people's redemptions out of new money so that the old money gets paid for. I mean, how is this scheme different from a hedge fund? It's not completely clear to us here.
Well, I think you're a little bit harsh on hedge funds, John. They, while it is true that they are very lightly regulated, they generally do try to put your money at work actually earning a return, because they typically profit from the gains that they can make on your money. They, like any other fund, even like a mutual fund or, as we discovered, a money market fund, are vulnerable to a wave of redemptions. If everybody decides they want their money out at the same time, just as with a bank, then they can suffer badly. And that's one of the things that we're braced for in the aftermath of this scandal.
Yep. In fact, the Financial Times reports this morning, and even I think you report this morning, that as much as $300 billion is locked up in hedge funds that now are not allowing redemptions until the first quarter of next year because they're so worried about this.
Yes, and of course, because of their regulatory scheme, they're allowed to do that.
Right. Well, Diana Henriquez, thanks so much for being a part of the program. Diana Henriquez is a senior financial writer for the New York Times. Thanks,
Thank
Diana.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.